Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's March 5th, 2017, and welcome to episode 148 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, upgrading, downsizing, you know, whatever. So here we are. It is the beginning of March, and I am Paul Hegstrom. I am joined today by Carrington Vanston. How are you, Carrington?
Speaking of downsizing,
you do look like you've lost weight.
So, yes, how are you?
I'm amazing.
Okay.
I continue to be
amazing.
That's
a surprise.
My stock is holding steady at awesome.
Woo! Yeah, okay, and then... Oh, and I suppose I should mention that you're in Toronto, shouldn't I? I don't know.
Yes.
This is off to a bumpy start.
Tell the people. And they can gather around me. Then, you ever have that dream where you're wearing sort of sun god robes and people are throwing little pickles at you? Why am I the only one who has that dream? 10 points to any listener who gets the reference.
I know.
10 points to Paul.
And then over in Portland, we can introduce Earl Evans. How are you?
Hey there, Paul. I'm doing very well. Thank you, sir.
So did you get the reference? Do we all have the reference?
No, I don't get the 10
little
points.
Pickles?
I did have the dream, though. So.
That's good enough.
That's even better. It's real genius. One of the best movies ever.
Oh, I haven't seen that in forever. Man, I love that flick. That's it. I'm gonna go get it.
It's a moral imperative.
Yeah, I periodically rewatch it. I mean, you know, it has its base moments, but it is it's a wonderful movie.
These are entries into the Frito-Lay sweepstakes. No purchase necessary. Enter as often as you want, so I am.
That's great. How many times?
Well, this batch makes it 1,650,000. I should win 32.6% of the prizes, including the car.
So, all right. Well, here we are. I guess we didn't talk about the weather, but, you know, it's cold.
Rain
and
wind.
I'll volunteer that.
It's very large outside.
So for Portland, you just have to ask the question, is it July or August? And if I say no, then it's rain and wind.
Yes, perfect. So today we have a host topic. The host topic is, and this actually was provided by Andy over email, so thanks, Andy, for this idea. But the topic is basically, how far should we go down the upgrade path toward modernity with our vintage machines? And in particular, what I'm thinking about here is, suppose you have like a 68030 Mac, and at the time, there were 68040 upgrades you could get, you know, so individual processor upgrade boards or, you know, clock accelerators or that sort of thing. You would have wanted to do this if it were 1993. The question is, do you want to do it now? Is it worth doing now? What would the point be? So I think that's sort of an interesting idea. So maybe I'll throw it out to you guys first. Earl, what thoughts do you have on retro upgrades to slightly less retro?
I think that I would probably do it if it was something that I used back in the day. For instance, I've got an IBM 5160 PCXT. And back then, I, at work, had an Intel 386 processor board for it. Really interesting device that you pop into one of the XT slots, and it had its own RAM on board and basically was the computer. I mean, you could think of it as a single board computer that you popped in your XT, but it could use the XT peripherals and all that. And slingshotted you into 386 land, which was awesome, and, you know, like, cut my compile times probably by 80%. So I'd get one of those, but if it wasn't something that I used back then, if it was just a curiosity, then I probably wouldn't do it. That's my take on it. I mean, a lot of the retro stuff that I do is for nostalgia's sake, and when I do get modern things for the computers that I have, it's typically not to make them super fast or super better. It's usually just to correct some of the issues that come up over age, like floppy disk degrading or RAM memory chips going sideways, that kind of thing. I usually don't like to turbocharge them because then, like you say, what's the point?
Right. I mean, you know, a super fast, you know, whatever it is, classic Mac is not a very fast machine.
Not compared to modern stuff, right? Exactly.
Yeah. So, well, Carrington, what thoughts have you on this?
My thoughts are many. No, actually, my thoughts are often few and scattered.
And unrelated, oddly, but...
I want to talk to you about fish. So I think my first reaction was, don't do any of it. That's just silly. Why would you upgrade any of these things? But then I started thinking about how I have treated and mistreated the various vintage computers that have passed through my hands. And I think it's more just accelerators I'm against. Pretty much everything else seems fair game and reasonable. It's only adding an accelerator just seems silly, because if you wanted a faster computer, why didn't you just pick up one of those models? So when I look at something like recently I was tweeting with somebody on Twitter, which is a good place for tweeting, I find, and talking about a Mac LC 475.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And so with my 475 I took out the LC chip and stuck in the full 040 chip. Mm-hmm. Just because why not? It just slots in, and it's something I would have done at the time, and it adds a bit of functionality in the same way that I put an Apple IIe card in it. That makes sense to me. So adding functionality, sort of maxing out a computer, maximizing the RAM, and even swapping to solid state storage all seems reasonable and sensible things to do. It's just the accelerator I'm against. But I think maybe it would also maybe a little bit depend model on model. So I'm not big on swapping out to like other data cards necessarily, other than I like putting the 2E card. If I had something like a Commodore 64, I probably would open it up and replace the entire internals with some soil, and then you can have a nice nice planter. Like, so I think it depends on the computer and your personal biases, of which I have many. I'm also willing to talk about fish.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, I think so. My thoughts on this are, well, first of all, it is kind of frustrating to use an old slow machine sometimes when you sort of know that it could go faster, since you have seen, you know, similar interfaces on faster machines. But for the nostalgia, yeah, I could sort of see it. Basically, you kind of want the speed that you had. And in its own day, when you actually were doing compiling on the machine, it might be nice to have a coprocessor that could you could send compilers off to use and stuff like that, but otherwise, so for sort of use purposes, it feels like I kind of wouldn't want to upgrade. But then the sort of other side of that is that upgrades were expensive. I mean, like the idea that you could, that, you know, some of these accelerators were just ridiculously expensive, and that sort of thing, you know, whatever, processor upgrades and things, and now they're not. I mean, some of them are. there is in particular a Apple IIgs accelerator, which is super expensive and just has not come down.
But it is useless, because if you have an old Apple II, let's face it, mostly we're going to use it for gaming. So an accelerator just is going to be disabled most of the time. Whereas if I'm using an old Mac, mm-hmm. I might be using it for fun production or something else other than gaming, in which case maybe an accelerator would be handy. And again, model by model. If I had a Mac 2CI or 2CX, I'm going to want to stick a floating point coprocessor in there, because they're mm-hmm. kind of crippled without it. So if I'm going to fire up Quark or something. So I guess it depends on the item. It's just accelerators that seem silly to me.
Yeah, and the one I was talking about specifically was for the 2GS, the Transwarp GS, which that makes the sort of like the GSOS operating system a little bit more functional. So I sort of make an exception with that, but partly that might be my own history because I never used the Apple IIgs. It was, you know, I skipped it in my own past. So it's still, I never got used to the slowness of it. But yeah, I mean, I guess, so the only thing that I can think of as a pro is just, you know, these were things that were inaccessible at the time. They're relatively speaking cheaper now. And so you could see what it would have been like to have a maxed out, you know, whatever it is, PCXT or Commodore 64 or whatever it is, Amiga. Yeah. So, I mean, I think for just to experience something that you didn't have a chance to experience before, that seems useful. But it won't, I guess in that case, it wouldn't bring back nostalgia.
Right, because if you want it fast as heck, you may as well just use an emulator. Right. Because then you can have that computer and that interface running just quite zippy. It does seem, though, silly to not max out some other things. Like, why have a retro computer without the most RAM it can support? Because everything is so cheap now, why would you intentionally hobble it and have it RAM-starved? So certain things just seem no-brainers, and other stuff I think comes down to the particular model or your interest or your intent. But if you're going to make it super modern, then why not just use a modern computer? Mm-hmm. Those are also available.
Yeah.
Apparently.
And occasionally they're cheaper. But anyway. Anyway, so I thought it was sort of, it's an interesting thing to think about. I guess I don't really have much more I wanted to say about that. I'm trying to think what kind of upgrades I've done. I mean, I guess I do, I say all of this and then the Apple IIe that I use most of the time runs at 10 megahertz, which is like 10 times its normal speed. And that's because I actually do use it for work, you know, like disk imaging and stuff, which does go much, much faster when it's accelerated. So I guess I got a pass on that, but otherwise I'm not sure that I really have done much upgrading. Okay. Any other thoughts people wanted to add?
Old computers are good. It's a thought.
And a nice, nice thought. Okay. Well, that was a short host's topic and it fits right in with our goal to try to bring this in under 3 hours. So we'll see if we can manage that.
Good luck to us.
Yep. All right. So actually, only a couple of things to mention in the listener feedback section. So Andy pointed out something in over email, I guess, which is something called the Black Annex. And this is only sort of, it's sort of like on the edge of retro. It's sort of a strange project. But so this was, somebody wrote, so now where's, somewhere the name will be McDonald. Somebody McDonald.
Lance McDonald.
Okay. Decided that he wanted to write a game and had some sort of experience with QBasic from 1991, which is a software interpreter for the basic programming language, sort of designed for, or at least designed capable of building kind of simple games. And Lance went and wrote an entire huge, looks like kind of like an RPG kind of game, all in QBasic, which is, of course, I think running much, much, much faster on, like, with many, many more pixels than would have been available in 1991. But it is a pretty full-fledged game written in QBasic, and it is about to be available, or maybe is by now, on Steam. It is a 12,000-line .bas file. It's neat. I'm glad that it's not me that's doing it, but it's pretty wild.
My favorite thing about it is it's a basic program with a minimum requirement of a 2.6 gigahertz processor to run.
Right.
Talk about a not optimized thing. I adore it. I love that it's got these crazy requirements.
It's a cool thing. It's amazing, actually, that it actually got finished. I mean, this is, looks like the sort of thing that would be a fun project. And then, you know, at the 10,000 line mark, you start thinking this maybe is a bad idea.
Well, and QBasic, I think, came with certain versions of DOS. I can't remember when Microsoft started including it. But if I recall correctly, I think it also has some more structured features. So, you know, you're not like line 10, do this, line 20, do that.
Okay.
It's a little bit more sophisticated than that. So perhaps writing in that flavor of BASIC isn't as arduous as what you might be thinking. You could there are some techniques to avoid the spaghetti code, but this is still a super impressive project. And, you know, speaking of accelerators, certainly nobody back in those days had a 2.6 gigahertz processor to run this with, so. So there's one good, I guess, excuse for an accelerator, huh?
Mm-hmm. And when I port this game to Logo, then
go turtle go.
wait for my requirements to be published.
Yes. Now they in this article, so the article is in PC World, and there's a demo of kind of like the thing that came with QBasic as a demo, the QBasic Gorillas, which is sort of like a I don't know, it's like an artillery game where you like each gorilla shoots a banana at the other gorilla and tries to hit it. It's very bizarre, but
have you never played that game?
Oh, no.
Oh, think, it's fun. It's kind of fun. Yeah. In a quirky, you know, sort of low speed way.
Mm-hmm. 35,000 lines per gorilla.
But I think part of the idea was that this is something Lance McDonald had this, already knew some QBasic, had worked on it as a kid and thought he wanted to make a game and had rather than learn a whole new platform, he knew QBasic, so he just took advantage of it in a modern scenario.
And the thing you make is better than the thing you wish you made.
Yeah.
So regardless, he did the right thing. So I know these tools. I could do what every programmer does always. I could spend a whole bunch of time refining my tools. Mm-hmm. I never write blog posts. I only make CMS things. But instead, he said, this is what I know. Let me just get into game making. And this is why he is a better person than I am.
It looks beautiful, at least in the trailer. I mean, like it is. It's a regular game. I mean, it looks fantastic. It looks like
gorillas
a team worked
are
on
phenomenal.
It. There should be somewhere in there like a
monkeys
little,
and typewriters.
Some room where you have gorillas throwing bananas at each other.
Every game should have that. Kansas Fest should have that.
Yes. Never mind about this bite the bag business. We should have banana launching.
We need gorillas chucking bananas.
Okay. So that was the main listener feedback, actually, was this pointing to this link. So,
well, most people have, we don't get a lot of feedback from the last show because I think people are still listening to it.
Yeah, true. Terry did write in to reassure us that we don't need to feel bad about keeping things safe in a box until we have time to enjoy them. So thanks for that. I will take that to heart.
Phew.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we can move on to the items of interest and news. And Carrington, you have the first one.
I have items of interest and I have news. So this is really cool. And I don't know how long this has existed, but I only just found it. And it's copyright 2017. So I call it news. If you played old games, especially things like the D&D games or Another World, and certain games would use as their copy protection a code wheel. So it would say, you know, you'd spin the little code wheel and it would give you a response code to type into the game. Sort of an updated, fun little interactive version of those, what is, you know, word 4 on line 7 of page 8 of the manual. The idea was, of course, that if you didn't have the code wheel, you wouldn't be able to play the game because you wouldn't have the response. And there would be just too many different things, like somebody couldn't just memorize it. You're basically having to repeat the whole thing. So somebody has made these code wheels and placed them online in an interactive form. So much more fun than just using a table to look up the responses. So if you are going to play, say, Monkey Island 2, then you can open up Monkey Island 2's code wheel in a web browser and respond to the question using a little spinnable interactive digital code wheel. And I adore it. And it's really well implemented and well done, whoever made this.
Yeah, that's cool. It is a lot better than just like looking it up on a table somebody typed in on a BBS.
Yep, so much more fun. And the code wheels are neat and pretty. Like they had a design to them, and each one looks different. And some are spirals, and they have different little windows to the numbers beneath. And it's fun to interact with them, and it's part of the experience of playing the game. So I give all the thumbs up for this. Well done.
15, 16 thumbs.
A minimum of 2 thumbs. I cannot commit it this time to how many thumbs.
Cool. Okay. So Earl, you have a video teardown to tell us about.
Yeah. So have you guys ever watched any of the videos from the EEV blog?
Yep.
Yeah, they're really good. So Dave Jones, I don't call me Davey, I guess, hosts that blog. And in this particular episode, he tears apart an Osborne 1. And I've never seen the inside of an Osborne 1, so this was really cool. Very high-resolution video, fun to watch. He's always fun to watch because he's so enthusiastic about everything he's doing. It's contagious. Mm. And in this episode, he talks about the design choices on the inside of the Osborne 1. Like, look at this. They use some folding ABS plastic to give the monitor a certain amount of shock absorption so it didn't break if it got dropped. And here are the chips. Here's the ROMs. Here's the CPU, which in this particular one was a NEC version of the Z80. And also, he showed the RAM chips. What was really funny about the RAM chips in this is they were from a variety of manufacturers. It's like they didn't even have one consistent RAM manufacturer in the thing. So this is kind of weird. Anyway, he talks about a bunch of stuff like this, so I won't do spoilers for any of the rest. But great video, and there's a couple things about the Osborne 1 that he wonders out loud, and I wonder if some internet research would have yielded the answers, but yeah, he just kind of wings it, you know, as he goes, and it's like, hey, look at this, look at that, and then when it's all done, he puts it back together and it still works. So, you know, golf clap, and a beautiful video. If you haven't seen it, and especially if you're a CPM enthusiast like I am and used to sell the Osborne 1s, it was just really cool to see. One of the things that he mentions is the price of the Osborne 1 was $17.95 when it came out. That's true. That's what we sold them for. And that was a great price when you considered all the software that you got with it, because you got WordStar, you got a database, you got a spreadsheet, you got some programming languages. Software alone was probably worth more than $1,800. Well, I know it sold for more than that at the time. So it's almost like, you know, the computer was just a freebie for buying the software. Great bundle, great price, terrible monitor. So
but they included that huge, luxurious monitor.
Yeah, room to spare.
Yeah, almost 2 glorious inches of monitor. What I learned from the teardown, of course, was that in that big case, most of the internals are actually a giant monitor. Then it uses a lens to shrink it down for the display on the outside. So just a real shame from a design standpoint.
But the clarity was worth it, Carrington.
Very clear. Very clear that this was a crappy computer.
Osborne 1 Retina display, I think, is what they called it. I'm just kidding about that, guys. All right.
What? Yeah, it is interesting to see the inside of this. Dave Jones has done a few of these kind of teardowns. If you go to this video, you can see in the sidebar, the TRS-80 Model 1 comes up, and the HP-85, and he did a Lisa. I haven't watched all of them. I did watch the Lisa one, and it is indeed the case that he does kind of wing it without a whole lot of internet research ahead of time.
Yeah, he does.
Vouch for that.
One of the great ones of these teardowns is when he tore down, I think it was a 5 or a 10 megabyte hard drive from an IBM mainframe. The thing was just enormous. This giant, you know, don't let it fall on you or you'll be, you know, pinned to death kind of hard drive. But it was really cool seeing him take it apart and explain the various innards. So, yeah, you know, all these teardown videos that he does are great.
All right, let's see. So I have the next one. This is just some random thing that I came across at a certain point. It is a paper. Let's see. When is it from? I guess it was posted first online May 26, 2016. It's an academic paper, you know, for neuroscientists called "Could a Neuroscientist Understand a Microprocessor?" It is by Eric Jonas and Conrad Paul Cording, and I think it is actually a relatively well-known paper in neuroscience. But what it is, so the actual kind of like idea behind it is, these people study the brains, and they have various ways of doing that, various sort of data analysis techniques, and trying to figure out like what's happening. And so, as kind of a, it's a bit of a snarky attempt here, but what it's basically trying to show is that if we applied those techniques that we apply to brains to something that we actually know the answers to, say, for example, a 6502 microprocessor, would we be able to figure out what it's doing? And the answer is no. But it's actually, it's sort of an interesting thing that they do. So they take a 6502 as their engineered model organism. And specifically, they are looking at Donkey Kong, Space Invaders, and Pitfall on an Atari 2600.
These guys just want an excuse to play games and get paid for it.
It seems like it's possible. But yeah, so what they did...
And I don't blame them. I'm not judging.
So essentially what they were doing was they attempted to run their sort of like connection tests on this, you know, like looking to see what things light up when certain inputs are provided. And the thing that I found most striking was they lesioned the 6502 in various ways to see what effect it would have on the game. So, you know, they coded the results by behavior where, like, if they put a lesion in a 6502 in a particular place, nothing would happen, or, you know, some particular behavior would break. It's a serious paper. I mean, like, they are trying to make a serious point, which is that, we the neuroscientists of the world, have a ways to go yet on our analysis techniques, but it's also sort of entertaining from the 6502 standpoint. So I thought that was worth pointing out. If you want to read a neuroscience paper.
Or if you want to replace your brain with a 6502.
Right. It worked for the Terminator, right? And Bender.
Exactly.
All right. Okay, Carrington, you have the next one.
I do indeed. Okay, so Future Shocked is the title of Dagan Brock's latest video, and it was fascinating, and I thought we should draw attention to it for our listeners. So Dagan, as I think we've discussed on previous shows, will post videos about programming, particularly geared towards the Apple IIgs, and this latest video is so fascinating. If you're interested in either programming or reverse engineering things, or in this case, something called the FuturePad. So the FuturePad was, and I did not know this before, a hardware interface for the 2GS. Seems like a pretty rare one. I'm not even sure if they actually got out into the wild. But there's a game that would use it. That game was, of course, unplayable without a FuturePad, and there are no FuturePads around, so what does one do? Well, if one is Dagan Brock, then what you do is in his remarkably calm... He's like the Bob Ross of programming. He's so calm. He's watching video, and it's so lovely. And I was like, oh, you fill me with such enthusiasm, and I just feel like I could actually do this. Very encouraging video. So he, in the video, looks at the FuturePad, but looks at disassembling a game and patching it to work with a different controller. So you have a piece of software, you would like it to work differently. This takes for like 10 minutes, a brief overview of just some high-level concepts, starting with really like the difference between binary and hexadecimal, like starting from real basics and the idea of assembling and disassembling, like assembling something and then listing it and looking at and like what you can tell from where, and just with a few basic concepts, then spends a half an hour looking through the code and sort of gently showing like, here's how you can see what's happening in a program, find the part of it that is looking to interact with this FuturePad, see how it is receiving data or sending it off to the rest of the program, and then by finding that section and saying it starts from here, goes to here, so that's like, you know, 35 bytes. So we've got 35 bytes that we could replace if we want to instead have a chunk of code that looks at a joystick and instead responds that way. Goes through, does that patching, and then shows the results of, look, now you can play the game with a joystick. It doesn't do like a full perfect patch, but it takes it up to the point where the game is now playable and would just need, you know, tweaks and polish. And it's really interesting and a nice, very understandable, very gentle approach to the idea of disassembling something, reverse engineering something, modifying an existing program. And I thought it was a very, very accessible video that might be of interest to a wide audience. So we'll have a link in the show notes, and it's really well done.
That's cool. Yeah, I haven't looked at this, but there's something that's sort of, I don't know, it brings me back to like a dark room with a single lamp, you know, in high school, kind of just sort of like hacking away on the computer. Like this mm-hmm. it's really like there's a kind of an atmosphere to this sort of project.
Yeah. And this is so well done, because this kind of thing, it can be very complicated and can be very difficult to explain to somebody or to watch what somebody's doing and even follow along. And Dagan is so good at conveying information in a very simple way and very clear, and talks much slower than I do. It's much more clear, and just like, it's such an accessible video, and I found it very entertaining. And I just think a lot of people, if you're interested in this kind of subject, but go, it seems a little complicated, this would be a great entry point to start off. Really, really well done.
I think I might actually be sort of interested in watching it, not only just for that, but also for familiarizing myself with the 2GS, because and I know that Dagan has other videos that are kind of introducing you to programming on the 2GS specifically, but like, I am relatively competent on the 8-bit Apple II, and I don't understand the banks of memory and all that stuff that in the toolbox and all that stuff that is 2GS specific. So this might be sort of like a sideways in, like,
yep.
For
yeah, and Dagan's videos are all really good. So yeah, big recommend.
Excellent. Earl, okay, you have more Commodore.
Yeah, it turns out that the world just can't get enough of Commodore history or findings. So
I have comments.
What a shocker.
But proceed.
So there's another documentary proposed over on Kickstarter, and it looks like it's just 2K shy of making their $21,000 goal. And they've got 45 days to go, so they're easily going to make it over the line, if not, you know, a huge overage. We'll see what happens. I'm not familiar with the producers of this. It's called The Commodore Story, Changing the World 8 Bits at a Time. But it looks like they've done their homework. I was looking through the Kickstarter page, and they've got lined up a bunch of the right people to talk to. And again, yeah, can't vouch for their production credits, although it looked like some of the folks were up on IMDb for other work that they've done, so could be very interesting. On this one, you can get in as cheaply as 10 British pounds if you just want the digital download of the film when it comes out. And like all these Kickstarters, as you go up on what you contribute, then you get better and better rewards, etc. And we'll have a link to it up in the show notes. And it looks like they're anticipating this coming out in December 2017, if I'm reading it right. Let me go back over there and take a look again. Yeah, estimated delivery December 2017. See, that seems to me to be a pretty short amount of time, having seen what it takes to put something like this together, all of the post-production and the editing and the decision-making and all that. I'd be shocked if they could produce something by 2017, but you know, maybe
it depends. They might already have a cut. They might have an EDL. They just need to render this thing and distribute it. Like,
right. They might be part of the way through it. So that's true. You're right.
And it's just a Commodore documentary. Like, they don't have to put a lot of effort in.
Yeah. Cause this one's for the masses, not the classes.
Exactly.
So that's my story, and you're stuck with it.
Yeah, I've got a fairly large backlog of documentaries I should be watching. But it's cool that there are more coming out. Actually, there's one that I will mention on the way out at the end of the show, too.
Get out!
Cool.
But, all right. Is it me next?
It is,
yeah,
you.
I think it is. You're about to blow everybody's minds, because this is crazy.
Yeah. This is pretty wild. So this guy, Ben Vandermeer, went to a Seattle Goodwill, and I think he was picking up like Apple II related magazines or whatever, and noticed that there were some, Apple letterhead things. And so he was sort of went digging around into the stuff at the Goodwill to sort of get it together. And what he wound up with apparently was a pile of documents, you know, sort of like internal memos and notes and things that belonged to Jack McDonald, who was the manager of system software for the Apple II and III. And so the specific topic that these were basically about was this program called Software Security from Apple's Friends and Enemies, or S-Safe, which is basically early copy protection issues. And so these were all things from basically 1979-1980, internal discussions about how, to what extent they should make the code available to people, and to what extent they should be able to serve as a kind of like a copy protection house. You know, so companies would send them software and they would bundle it up, and they sort of, the memos show sort of debates going back and forth, and people evaluating other you know, like companies' existing software protection. And they're, you know, the big names in the Apple, you know, early Apple community in here. So there are notes. Randy Wingenton wrote a note to Jack, you know, whose documents these are, saying, you know, Jack, I broke VisiCalc's scheme. Elapsed time, 1 hour, 15 minutes, which is pretty cool.
4 a.m. would like to comment on that.
Yeah.
And my favorite was the subject of one of Randy's things, which was good Apple versus bad users.
Yes. It's really quite interesting. I mean, they're just, you know, it's just miscellaneous notes about the development of this and like what they wanted to get out of it. And after having worked on it for a while, it spans about a year or so, you know, and essentially after having worked on it for a while, kind of deciding maybe this actually isn't what we want to be doing, you know, we'll provide some sort of low level protection that people can buy to use, but then we don't want to be responsible. And there was this thing called DOS 3.3P that they protected a lot of their early in-house stuff with and sold. So you can see that sometimes on disk labels, you know, it was DOS 3.3P for protected, I guess. But anyway, it's pretty interesting to see kind of like just the internal memos. There isn't anything that's, I think, you know, super sensitive there, but it is stuff that we would not have been able to see otherwise. And quite a bit of it is in actually, you know, either handwritten notes to Jack or Jack's handwritten notes. So anyway, take a look at that. That is quite cool.
What was this doing in a thrift store? I mean, this is the find of the century.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, like, I assume that, I mean, so I have not myself. Oh yeah, I should maybe also mention that it was not only about the Apple II, but the Apple III, which was also being, you know, discussed at that time. But yeah, so I don't know what Jack McDonald's status is right now. I'm hoping this isn't, you know, like stuff dumped after an estate sale. But you know, I presumably it's just at some point, you know, a pile of Jack's magazines which had these in them got taken to Goodwill in a downsizing effort of some sort. This story went everywhere. I mean, so the link that I have here is a Gizmodo story, but I saw it on, like, I think it was like Popular Mechanics and Fortune, and, you know, like big, you know, it has a sort of fairy tale, you know, narrative to it, I guess, in a way. So you can see why people jumped on it. But
and yet I missed it completely. This is my discovery of this. Like I completely, I don't know. It's all fake news out there. And yeah. So I was ignoring everything. I ignore everything except you, Paul.
Hooray. It's pretty cool. I haven't read through it, every word of it yet, but I really am quite interested. And particularly in that, you know, the part about protection on the Apple III, which is referred to as Sarah, because at that point that was what it was called, named after Wendell Sanders' daughter. But
I also like that even at this case, they're all talking about how there's no such thing as perfect protection. Like the only way to make something totally uncrackable would be to not make the software actually usable. Like if you can get access to it, that regardless, it can be cracked. But then they conclude if they can come up with a protection scheme good enough that Woz can't crack it, well, then that's well protected enough. Because if we can keep it from Woz, we can keep it from most people.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so there's actually another thing that I had put in the show notes, which I didn't warn anybody about, but there we're entering, you know, vintage computer gathering season. So there are many upcoming shows that probably deserve at least a little bit of a mention. There are so many that I don't think any one of them will get a lot, though I think Kansas Fest will get a little bit of a discussion here.
Heard of it.
So
that's the place where the gorillas throw the bananas, right?
I think so. Yeah, I think that's what I'm hoping that we'll we'll see there. But the soonest, the closest one is, I think, VCF East, which is March 31st, so just a couple weeks away. And that is in New Jersey at the InfoAge Science Center. If you were unaware of that for some reason, become aware of that. There will be links to all of these things in the show notes. If you are somewhere near there, you should go. The 26th annual Last Chicago Cocoa Fest is April 22nd to 23rd. So
that still tickles me that they call it that.
It is wonderful, yes, in Lombard, Illinois. There's a whole pile of VCFs, of course. So VCF Southeast coming up soon after that, April 29th and 30th in Roswell, Georgia. VCF Europa, I think we mentioned that before, but that's April 29th to May 1st also. So you can only go to one of VCF Southeast and VCF Europa, but so it goes. Kansas Fest 2017 is July 18th to 23rd, and I think I saw that the registration opens at the end of this month, end of March. And there is one sort of interesting bit of news is that a generous community builder has offered to sponsor 5 first-time attendees for their registration. So there is a kind of a lottery, a golden ticket lottery, and we'll have a link to the announcement of that. But essentially, if you have never gone before and you want to go, then you can put yourself in the lottery for this. And if successful, if you get through, then your registration will be covered and you just have to get yourself there. And the lodging and food is pretty much covered. At least during the run of the actual conference, there's your food and lodging is taken care of for you. So it's a wonderful thing. It is probably unique in this list as in that it is pretty much a week long, and it's kind of a little bit like a retreat. So. And we talk about it nonstop. So, anyway, Convex V13, July 29th to 30th in Las Vegas. The VCF West 12 has been announced. That's in August 5th to 6th, 2017, at the Computer History Museum. VCF Midwest 12 is in September 9th to 10th in Elk Grove Village, Illinois. And I think that's all I had. Oh, yeah, the VCF Midwest 12 is meeting along with the Emergency Chicagoland Commodore Convention. So, yes.
And also, Convex, they just announced a couple days ago that they're changing the venue for the 2017 show back to the hotel that they normally hold it at. There was some kind of snafu with registrations that didn't permit them to hold it there, or at least they thought it might not, but then things got resolved here fairly recently, so they're going back to the Plaza Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada, and all of that is up on the Convex website, which I think you've got a link to here in the show notes.
Ah, okay, cool, yeah. Yeah, there are many, many shows, so everybody should go to some show.
VCF My Den, which will take place this afternoon at around 5:30.
Yeah, actually, come to think of it, there's a couple of Australian Apple II gatherings. There's a smaller one that I think is happening somewhere in there that I failed to mention anything about. But if Michael were here, he could tell us sometime in April. Oh, I think.
Would he?
Okay. Anyway, so many, many things that you can go to in the coming months. We will try to keep mentioning things that are coming soon, and of course, surely we're missing some. Atari seems not to be represented in there, really, even though Apple and Tandy Radio Shack and Commodore are. So if there are Atari gatherings, let us know. Or any others.
Kansas Fest, apparently.
Yeah, seems to be, yeah. I thought there was a pet one, too, actually. But
there's the Toronto T-Pug meet here.
Yeah, the World of Commodore.
I wonder if they've got a big meeting.
World of Commodore. Okay. I have to look that up.
Let me World of Commodore. Check that.
Unfortunately, it's difficult to go to the World of Commodore because they only let in the classes. Bunch of hypocrites.
Right. Yeah, so if we are missing your favorite gathering or the one you are organizing and then let us know and we will try to keep some sort of mention of it. I think I'm not going to commit to keeping an up-to-date list anywhere, but we'll try to mention them as we come across them.
I wonder if there is
one. I should add one more. There's going to be a Pacific Northwest Commodore Expo, as it turns out. It's going to be in it's June 10th and 11th at the Living Computer Museum in Seattle, Washington.
Plus labs.
Yep. That's right. Plus L. And this is in my neck of the woods. So this should be exciting.
I'm surprised there's not an official, or maybe not official, but some sort of canonical calendar for retro computing events that you could just subscribe to. I mean, it's very easy to publish a calendar. And I would probably subscribe to it. So it's funny, I don't know that that exists. So if it does, and you're a listener, then and you know about it, then let us know.
Mm-hmm. Well, or be the change you want to see in the world. Yeah.
No, Commodores still exist. I'm not that change.
Well, all right. So perhaps that is enough festivities for the moment. And now, a word from our sponsor.
IBM presents a remarkable technological advancement. Peace and quiet. It comes with a line of typewriters so advanced they make no more noise than this. IBM QuietWriter typewriters. As with any IBM typewriter, there's only one thing to say.
I love it. We're your type.
And we're back. So, I am the host. Hello. And as the host, I am responsible for choosing the retro computing gift idea, and the thing that came to mind is the very recently released Raspberry Pi Zero W, the Raspberry Pi Zero wireless development port. It is not retro at all, but it is useful for retro things, and I think this is probably I'm quite looking forward to seeing where this goes. So it has the problems that all of the Raspberry Pis do when they are new, in that you can't get them. But the Raspberry Pi Zero is it's basically a Raspberry Pi 0.5. It's like the Raspberry Pi Zero, which was a very stripped down development board, but it has wireless in addition. So it's sort of like it builds it back in a couple of the things that you wanted. So I am looking forward to this. They are $10 if you can find them. So practically nothing. The Micro Center store, of which there are several, but one is near me, has them. It's one of the distributors for them. And they have their pricing scheme is you get one for $10 because that's what they cost. And if you want to buy more, then they cost more each. So
it's actually for something like this, though. That's a good way to do it.
Yeah. So you can, if you want to buy more than six, you can, but they cost twice as much.
It also has Bluetooth. It's got Bluetooth Low Energy. So it's got both Wi-Fi and BLE.
Yeah, that's what makes this so exciting, because for $10, I mean, adding back in a way to sort of interact with this wirelessly is amazing. Like, that really opens up a lot of potential uses for this.
Yeah, the idea, like, so it doesn't, I think it still doesn't come with pins. You know, so you have to solder in your own, like, GPIO pins. But the idea that you could basically hide this in your case of your retro computer and have this be your, you know, disk drive or whatever, or network server. Very cool. So I've always kind of wondered, I think we may have wondered aloud about this on the show before, but whether something like this could kind of make obsolete a number of those kind of like computer specific wireless or internet connection boards, where, you know, you get a Raspberry Pi Zero and an adapter, and it goes into your Commodore, or you get a different adapter, and it goes into your Apple II, or whatever.
Maybe. The only issue with that tends to be that some of the protocols on the retro computers are very timing sensitive, and the Raspberry Pi is running a multitasking operating system, has trouble doing things that are highly timing deterministic, if that makes sense, which is why in a lot of those cases you'll see some bare metal solution like an Arduino or some other kind of microcontroller in there, where they're, you know, writing straight to the iron and there's no operating system that's goofing up the timing. So that is one of the challenges that you have with a full-fledged multitasking operating system. It's doing a bunch of things and you can't necessarily count on it for very precise timing. If it's just serial or something like that, though, just RS-232 serial or whatever, then yeah, it's perfect.
And there are some, like, I haven't explored it too carefully, but there are some Raspberry Pi bare metal things you can do. Like, you don't absolutely have to run Raspbian or whatever. But at that point, I suppose there is a question of why don't you just get a different microcontroller. The nice thing about the Raspberry Pi is that everything, it has, you know, it has all the I/O on it as well. So anyway, it's I will definitely get one of these to add to my pile of, you know, various flavors of Raspberry Pi that I don't know what to do with. But maybe this one I'll use.
Perfect gift.
You know,
and cheap.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, that's always been the thing. But you know, back when they first came out, I think it was the first. Might have been the Model B, but I think it might have been the Model A. You know, the whole point of this was it's like this cheap, widely available computer, but of course they weren't available, you know, because they couldn't keep up with the demand. And so I think I bought on eBay, like, I don't know, it probably cost like four times what it would have normally cost to get it, and I got it, and then I didn't know what to do with it, and, you know, eventually they became available and then became, you know, more powerful and smaller. And I still have, I think that original one that I paid too much for on eBay is probably going to power my Pi DP. But anyway, moving on. eBay auctions is the next section. And Carrington, you have the first set.
I'm doing the full Paul. Got a Hooray. Few different ones to talk about. The first is something I tweeted about a little earlier. A Power Macintosh 8500, which is a nice little model, for a buy it now under $100. So that's what really appealed to me. It is seller refurbished, seems to be working totally fine, and less than $100 plus a bit of shipping. So I thought that was a very good price for one of these. Like most of this sort of model, like, it comes in the same case that the 800, the 840 AV did, the 8100, they're all basically that same case, which is my favorite of the old vintage Macintosh tower cases. I like it better than the larger one, the 9500 case. So I really like this. It's a sweet spot for a mini tower. Like most of them, the front panel and the back panel and the little feet part of the bottom have yellowed, and that middle horseshoe of metal that slides over most of the case looks gorgeous. So you'd have to just sort of clean up the front if you want it to look aesthetically pretty, which you should, because pretty matters. Well, I don't know, it doesn't matter, does to me anyway. But anyway, for $98, I thought it was a pretty good deal for a work in one of these. So if you were interested and it is still for sale, then it might be one to snatch up. Second choice was an IBM QuietWriter, which is a printer, the QuietWriter Model 2. A couple of things I like about this is, one, I love daisy wheels. So I'm always just looking at daisy wheels because I just think they're so pretty. This is a wide carriage one. I prefer the ones in general, like the Diablos and stuff, that just take a normal size piece of paper, maybe sideways, a letter size, but that's it, because otherwise they become monstrous beasts. However, if you have a whole old IBM PC setup, then this is the sweet printer to stick on your very large and hopefully weight supporting desk that you put all these things on, because it, you know, just, it's got that same look, and it looked beautiful right beside it. And so it's really, really lovely printers. And an example of what I think is lovely naming, because this is an early enough thing that they didn't do the camel case. It's a lowercase W on the QuietWriter. So it's just IBM QuietWriter, and only the Q is capital. And for that alone, it is worth buying, even though it is $250. So pretty expensive, but I don't see a lot of these things. So lovely printer, and works, just needs a new ribbon or a little bit of inking, but the current ribbon, well, faint, is working fine. So there's that. And third choice is, I talked about one of these recently because I'm a big fan of the model, and this isn't the particular model that I like. It's the Apple Studio Display, but this is the DVI version, the later one, so not as good for a lot of super old retro things because it doesn't have those AV inputs, but it does have the DVI, which is relatively easy to interact with VGA or other things, so easy to put this 15-inch LCD look at retro and have it work with a retro computer. What's neat about this is, although it's a bit expensive at $300, it's new old stock. So if you want to get yourself something pretty fresh, while the box is open, a lot of things are still sealed. Comes with the little display adapter, the little a little stand that can go on the bottom if you want to have it the lean back sort of style instead of the adjustable up and down stand. Well, that comes to you, and all the cables and all the software and all the everything. So if you want a really minty version of one of these, then for $300, this one could be yours. So those are my three choices.
Cool. Yeah, the I don't know. I guess I have never actually tried to take it off, but I was just looking at the studio display monitor, and it looks very pretty, except that there's this kind of like green and red sticker in the lower left corner, and mine has that too. Like this is exactly the one that's like sitting on my desk, and I actually here just a second. Okay, I think you can peel it off.
we'll hear a cracking noise in a second from Paul's microphone. We had my family ran a cyber cafe for a while, of all things. Remember that word? That was a thing. And so we had a very, very large one here in Toronto. And we had a massive section of one of the floors with a bunch of computers that you could do some design work on. And they all had these studio displays for a while. And none of them had those stickers on it. So I thought, well, okay, they must be removable, because I would have removed 25 of them or something. And I would have remembered if they were on there, because it would have really annoyed me if they had stayed. So it must be.
Yeah, because they look terrible. I mean,
but like, is it still removable after all these years is the question, though. So.
True. Yeah, and I like, just to go back to a couple of these, the QuietWriter looks like an IBM. There's something that's very pleasing about IBM design. Mm-hmm. So.
And if you want to get your full Doogie Howser on, this can help complete that, I think. You're doing your Doogie Howser typing on your Doogie Howser IBM PC, and then you can print it to this lovely IBM printer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Doogie uses this printer, but it would aesthetically, I feel it would fit in.
Yeah, I think it might fit in a little bit better with something like the PS2 line than the original XTs. I guess they'd go okay with an AT.
Yeah, I don't know. Either that or like, you know, a 3270, you know, like going back a little bit. Because it looks sort of like the mainframe stuff. All right. Earl, speaking of typing.
Yes, well, I have something that is possibly ugly to all but the well-trained eye.
Yeah. It's going to take me a while.
Eek! This is a Siemens TS-100 teletype. And how best should I describe it? It looks old. It looks ancient. It's a stand-up on one of those typical teletype stands. It has the kerchunky-looking keys. On the left, you've got a tape punch, I think, and on the right, a tape reader. It has buttons and a rotary dial telephone, which I have to assume was connected up to some sort of a modem or something like that inside this teletype. This really gives you that 1950s computer feel. I mean, you can imagine this in, when I was at NASA this last summer and I visited the old mission control room, a couple of the consoles that they had in there looked very much like this, with the rotary dial telephone on there and the big kerchunky keys. But this thing looks boxy and like it weighs a ton. And if you open it up, there's probably, you know, 2 to the 9th power springs in there. Mm-hmm. I just love the look of it, though, which is what I mean by the trained eye. I mean,
I love how the keys, they're solid squares. Like, what am I trying to say? What is the name of
massive.
That shape?
They're like little monoliths.
They're very tall.
They are. They're like little monoliths. That's true.
They're tall and they don't, you know, and it's not a key cap, but that's like, it's extruded all the way up.
Right. And one can only imagine what this sounds like if you actually power it up. And by the way, there is no guarantee that this does power up. This could be a hollowed out shell. We don't know. Because they don't.
So could I. I think it's gorgeous. I love the rotary dial. That totally sells it for me. Mm-hmm. I think if you're looking for the perfect thing to tweet from, then get this and engineer something. That would be like make my life complete. Or if you need for some reason to communicate with Colossus, the voice of world control, this also looks like a suitable way to do that. I love everything about this thing.
Absolutely.
If you look at the keyboard, you know, it's a sort of a minimal keyboard. They've got a few punctuation marks, but so there's a close up of the keyboard. It has, you know, 1 to 9 and 0 in the top row, and then a few special characters like an Enya if you wanted to make Spanish, and some kind of Iron Cross under the D, and then they have a little, it's like a Space Invaders, like a little sneakers
under
guy
under the J. It's got like a built-in Space Invaders character for some reason.
I don't know what that is, but
which is
I also
helpful.
Like that it has a less than but no greater than.
Right.
We only flow in one direction on this keyboard.
It's very, very modest.
And it would cost me, if I just wanted to pay it, to buy it now, which one of the things that I liked about this in my every 2 week scouring of the eBay, I find a bunch of things that are overpriced and it just irks me. This, I think, is a reasonable price for what it is, $450. And if you don't think that's a reasonable price, you can make an offer, which I love those, because then, you know, you get what the market will bear. However, if I bought it, it would cost me $290 to have it shipped from its current location in Caracas, Venezuela. And I don't know what it would cost to ship to you guys, but no matter what, it's a lot of money. If you don't happen to be in Caracas.
You can't get here from there, so.
Venezuela. So, but, you know, even with that, it doesn't seem like that is so completely unreasonable.
No, it's probably, I mean, it's probably fairly unique at this point. I mean, like, I imagine a lot of these just got trashed.
Right.
So. And so if you really hate these things and you want to get rid of the last one, this
buy
is
it and then bulldoze it. That's right. Carrington.
I get that a lot.
Okay, so I guess I am up next, and speaking of buying and bulldozing, the first two things I have are a Lisa 1 front bezel and a Lisa 1 Twiggy drive pair. I think we've probably, I'm not sure if we've talked about these before. I think we may have, not these particular ones, but the Lisa machine was the first version of it had these 5 1/4 inch, they were called Twiggy drives, which had extra, it basically had two windows on them and a lot of extra weird notches and stuff like that. And they were quite unreliable. And so relatively quickly they brought out the Lisa 2, and they, because of the unreliability of the Lisa 1, they had a free kind of like upgrade program. So they took out the 5 1/4 inch drives and replaced it with a 3 1/2 inch. And because of that, they also had to replace the front bezel. And other than that, the internals between the Lisa 1 and the Lisa 2 are basically the same. So except I think the Lisa 1 had batteries that the Lisa 2 did not. So at any rate, Lisa 1s, because there was this free upgrade program, are incredibly rare. I mean, like, you just cannot find them. What is being offered here is a Lisa 1 front bezel that has the two, you know, large 5 1/4 inch slots in the front, and actually says Lisa on it. For some reason, the Lisa 2 machine does not say Lisa on it anywhere, except inside. The Lisa 1 actually had a nice little apple and a Lisa logo on the front. And then the second auction has the actual drive cage, though, that has both the has two Twiggy drives of, you know, who knows if they're working, but they, you know, these are the things that go behind the slots. So if you wanted to take a Lisa 2 that you have, if you have one, you can kind of, like, I don't know, downgrade it back to essentially a Lisa 1 by replacing the front bezel and putting in these Twiggy drives, which may or may not work.
Uh-huh, but that would be, first you're buying the front bezel, just mm-hmm. that piece of plastic, for the low, low price of $520. And you say, oh, great, now I'll go buy these drives, which will be $3,600 more.
Yeah.
Are these normal prices for this? This seems outrageous to me.
Well, so here's the thing. I put these in right when they were listed. And right when they were listed, before they had gotten any bids, or maybe when they had gotten one bid, the price was $9.99 each. Like these are going to go for whatever the market will bear, because they started at basically nothing. I don't understand people who jump in when there are 9 days left and bid $3,600. I don't know what they're doing. These are going to go... Probably both of these are going to go for a huge amount. The bezel is going to go for a lot less, I think, than the Twiggy drives, because you just can't get Twiggy drives anymore. But yeah, so it'll be interesting to watch, but not probably something any of our listeners is likely to be buying.
Because it would seem silly if the front bezel goes for more than the cost of a very good 3D printer.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because it is itself just a big chunk of plastic. So...
Yeah, no, and I was actually, so there was some discussion, I think, of retrobriting techniques or something on some Facebook group I was I was in, and there was a, you know, so retro writing is this technique of putting, it's basically like hydrogen peroxide, I think, on your plastics that will remove the top yellow layer that has come up allegedly from the fire retardant chemicals, I don't know, heating up or whatever, getting exposed to sunlight. And so retrobrating does a relatively good job of kind of returning things.
Wait,
so to
is
white.
There any chance that's what's happened to your president? Just a question from a Canadian.
Don't know.
Float that up there.
I am unsubscribing from the feedback email for this.
Nah, well, anyway, yeah, I mean, let's see, where was I going? Oh, yeah, so it's talking about retrobrighting. So the another thing that you could do, I mean, so sometimes people have posited abrasive kind of techniques too, because basically it is just the top layer that yellows on these things. And of course, the problem with actually like scrubbing them is that you lose the texture that there was. And so Tony Diaz at some, it might have been like 2011 or something like that, there was some Kansas Fest that was prior to the first one that I went to, but he had demonstrated something he called retroblasting, which was basically taking, I think, compressed air, and it's like sandblasting, but he did it with something like very fine flour or something like that. And it actually did a pretty good job of removing the yellow while retaining the texture. But what I remember about this is now we come back to the connection, is that in his presentation, he had one of these Lisa 1 bezels. He's just waving it around like it was just some piece of plastic. It was kind of hard to see. So if you want to see someone treating something that is relatively precious and rare in a very casual way, watch any video that Tony Diaz is in.
That's awesome.
But, okay. Yes. So, and actually the bulldozing connection is just that the Lisa, when they finally gave up on it, they'd given a bunch of these to Sun Remarketing to sell. And eventually Apple wanted to take a tax write-off on it. And the only way to do that is basically to prove that they had been destroyed. So they took all the remaining Lisas away from Sun Remarketing in Logan, Utah, I think, and ran over them with bulldozers and buried them. So, and that's why they're expensive today. All right, I had a couple other things that were not like that. Actually, let me jump to the other like outrageously expensive thing, which is there's a DEC PDP-8S mini computer, complete and with documentation available. If you want it, it is a starting bid of $12,500, or you could buy it now for just to basically $4,000 more, $16,250. That seems like a lot.
I feel like this is over market for that. I mean, my guess is that it won't get any bids at this price.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. I was kind of curious about this. The description is actually relatively elaborate, and it talks about this being basically kind of like the bargain version of the PDP-8. After the original straight 8, what they basically cut down on some components and made a kind of a cheap version that runs absurdly slowly, even for a PDP-8.
Well, and when you're looking at all of the flip chip boards in this thing, remember, this is the stripped down version.
Right.
If you look at the top down version of that circuit card, there's like a million of those cards in there that make up this thing. It's pretty amazing.
My initial reaction to this was, how could that possibly be complete? It is like one rack-mounted unit, and it doesn't actually have a cover either, because it's intended to be, you know, hidden in a rack. And I guess they said that the power supply is actually a separate rack-mounted unit, but I'm surprised that's all there is. I mean, I guess, you know, you could add peripherals like a disk drive, I guess, or I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you communicate with these things apart from watching the lights and flipping the switches. The one thing about this that partly caught my attention, apart from just it being rare and it being expensive, is that it although it's $200 shipping, it's right near me, so I could go pick it up if I wanted to pay the whatever it is, $13,000. But maybe I could go look at it. Anyway, so I thought it was kind of interesting. I don't know my PDPs well enough to know how rare this is, but I suspect given if I, you know, if we believe the auction description, this probably is quite rare because it's sold very poorly because it's a junky machine.
Ooh, so, gotta have it.
Yeah. Anyway, interesting to see. In the weird category, I have located an auction for an ExpandoVision. Oh, and it's gotten some bids.
This is creepy.
This is bizarre. Yes. So it's only kind of retro computing related, I guess. But what it is it's a, you know, it's a kind of like self-help device that will feed you subliminal messages generated by your computer while you watch TV. So it's, I guess, expanding your mind. ExpandoVision, straight to the mind's eye. A new subliminal home computer program. So I think this is the... It looks to me like this is the VIC-20 version. There's a picture of the VIC-20 on the cover, but they actually made versions of this for various machines, including the Atari 400, 800, and I think the Commodore 64.
Well, I'm sure it's pretty easy to port something that is a load of garbage that doesn't actually have any functionality. Oh, look, I just ported it to two more computers during that sentence.
Yeah, no, I think so. It maybe Earl, you can recognize this. I think there's a cartridge that says. Well, the cartridge that is inside the boxes looks to me like it's VIC-20 sized. Does
yes.
that look like a VIC-20 cartridge to you?
Yeah, it's one of those ginormous cartridges.
Yeah. So that's why I was thinking that it probably belongs to the VIC-20. But I mean, so essentially, as I understand it, there's an interface box, and you plug in your computer and your television, and you can switch it to the computer to watch your computer, like play your games or whatever, and switch it to television to watch TV. And if you put it in ExpandoVision in the middle, it will generally show you the television, but like once every 30 frames or something like that, it will quickly show you a frame from your computer and then go back to the television. And so your computer will be generating, you know, things that will help you control stress and think positively, or calm nerves and control smoking, or whatever it is that you're trying to do. There are four of the eight possible things included here, including career success, motivation, stress control, positive thinking, sexual confidence, and weight control exercise. So it's a weird thing.
And a copy of Fight Club.
Yeah. So anyway, hadn't seen anything like this before. It by now has three bids, so it is up to $107.50. So,
well, that's something we should warn people. If you look too closely at the auction, it will make you bid. So those people, unfortunately, had the screen up too long. So do take care when you look at our links this week.
Yes. I assume none of us had one of these. I did not.
Not that I'm going to admit.
Right. But you are very, very calm and successful in career. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. So, the other things are sort of less exciting. I there's a relatively cheap Epson HX20 that I wanted to link to.
Well, that's
exciting. They're kind of cool.
I'm the high bidder.
Are you seriously?
Yeah, I am. I looked at that. I was like, cha-ching. Thank you, Paul.
Do you want me to, like, we can cut this out?
No. I'm not that mercenary.
But, they look pretty. I think, you know, so the HX20 is a little bit of an island, I think. You know, it doesn't run anything that anything else talks, as far as I understand it. But
yeah, it is its own thing.
But it has a little cassette, a little micro cassette, and a printer, and small LCD display. And it has an expansion unit. I suspect they all do.
They don't. They don't all. And I think the expansion unit's a little more rare than the HX20 itself. Neither of them are unobtainium, but, you know, you don't see them every day either. The thing that I really love about this auction is the thing looks beautiful. There's a couple of smudges, but otherwise, cosmetically, it's in really good shape. It's got the cassette unit. Not all of them have that. It's got the Epson carrying case, and I really would like to have one of those for my existing HX20. So, yeah, this is a nice unit. And, you know, it turns out that if the battery doesn't work in the HX20, then the whole thing's kaput. So, in some cases, people think they're dead when all they need is a replacement of the NiCad unit, and then it springs back to life.
Ah, cool. Also, this the case here has been... modified so that you can get at. I can't quite see what it is you can get at. The power and I think the RS-232 port. So you can close this thing up in its case and continue to power it and have it run whatever it is that it was doing on the I/O port.
Or maybe use it with the case top open but without taking out of the case. Like if you were using it to hook up to there was a phone acoustic coupler that was also battery powered. I think you've got one, right? The CX-20 that came with the Epson HX-20. It'd be nice to not have to take it out of the case every time you wanted to use it.
Cool. Yeah. No, it just they do look very nice as well. So I don't know what it is about the particular color scheme, but very Epson. Okay, and then the last one, I don't know if this was a good idea or not, but anyway, there is a Farallon Etherwave Mac PowerBook adapter. And so this is not nearly as retro as the other things, but I got one of these thinking it was a good idea, and so since I saw another one get listed and it's not super expensive, I thought I would offer this up as a suggestion. Basically what it is designed to do is to get your old PowerBook or Mac on an Ethernet connection, which is like more and more useful now since AppleTalk connections and modem connections are no longer particularly easy. So what's cool about this is that it has the whole box. It's not even opened. So whatever software was in there and manuals and stuff are still there. And it's designed to work, I think. So the Mac thinks it's a local talk port, but this is basically just a conversion. So you can do what this is doing by having an entire Mac sitting as your bridge Mac, you know, so it has one that has Ethernet and local talk, but this is a way to do that without having an extra Mac.
I was a big fan of the Farallon products, like the Etherwave and all those. They're well made. They always work great for me. So I think this is a good find.
And it is an auction starting bid of $39, which seems pretty good given that it's in its box and unopened. I mean, I think if you might be able to find a miscellaneous one, but I think it's kind of cool to actually have the manual too. So, and I think that's it for me. So, oh, and I'm the host, so I guess I have to keep things moving myself. All right, so we can move now to the closing discussions, and looks like we've all put some kind of notes in here. Carrington, you have an opinion.
Do I? What have I put in the notes here? Oh, yes, Cosmo Music. Ah. I bought some audio stuff, and if you're ever going to buy audio stuff of any sort in Toronto or near Toronto, do not purchase from Cosmo Music. Very bad experience from them. They lied to me. Ah, crazy. On the other hand, though, I just stumbled across Affinity Designer, which has been the thing I've been doing all day is playing with that. It's basically an Illustrator competitor, but rather than spending $60 a month or whatever I've been spending for the last 10 years on Illustrator, it is like a one-time purchase of $69, and it's amazing and just rocking my world. So hooray for that. Works for prepress, works, does everything I want, but for a remarkably lower price and a snappier, fun interface, and really digging it so far. So strong recommend for that. I think I've been using it for 3 hours, but so far I love it. Cosmo Music, on the other hand, crazy. I went and bought just a little microphone adapter, needed something with at least 40 decibels of gain. Went for one product. They didn't have it, so a guy recommended another one. I said, well, is this guy? He goes, absolutely. That's the main reason to use it, is it's got 65 decibels of gain and it's totally clean. You're good. Take it home, open it up. Nope, goes from minus 10 to plus 10. Take it back the next day. I can't take it back because it's got software. I'm like, but it's a hardware device. Ah, but it came with a free trial version of software. So therefore they won't take it back. I'm like, but you lied about what it was. Nope, still no returns on software. We're going to call this software. I'm like, I will burn your store to the ground. That's my current feelings about Cosmo. Who are not sponsoring this podcast, sorry, in case you're wondering.
Yeah, I was just thinking when you were talking about Affinity Designer that we should get some sponsors. But so you tweeted about that a few hours ago.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like like most people, if you're in design stuff, I've been using the Adobe software since forever. Illustrator just hit 30 years, which means I've been using it for 30 years, and Photoshop for almost that long. And in design, since I basically gave up Quark, which seems like 15 years ago. Like, so But and the expense of it is bonkers. If you're not a magazine publisher and it's just a thing you have to do on occasion, like make flyers or do something in pre-press, like I have to, then it's very expensive software. So I'm always on the lookout for something that I would be consider more reasonable for my uses, and yet still have to work with spot colors and Pantone numbers and just, you know, it's got to do all the funky pre-press stuff. And this Affinity been around for a while. I'm like, what the heck is this for $69? That's so good. So very impressive.
Yeah, no, I haven't, I'd never heard of it before, but, so I did of course follow the link when you tweeted it, because that's what I do. There's the one that you're talking about, Affinity Designer, is kind of like a Illustrator, I guess.
Right.
It's sort of an Illustrator competitor. They do have one called Affinity Photo, which is a Photoshop competitor as well. And that's, I'm kind of curious about that, because I use Photoshop a lot in scanning, you know, so I've actually been doing a fair amount of this, like, scanning of whatever, you know, magazines and stuff like that. Then I, you know, I run it through Photoshop to try to get rid of the yellow tint and increase contrast and stuff like that. And so there's a, you know, sort of batching that I do with it. But it's slow. I mean, I don't know. There are various things that it doesn't do particularly well, and it's super expensive. So I'm actually kind of curious to see. I have submitted for my free trial, you know, to try out to see if it can replace Photoshop in my scanning pipeline, because I think that would be quite nice. And actually, also,
Designer is bonkers quick, and weirdly, it uses this .af file format. Well, I'm always worried about, oh, okay, what's this file format? Mm-hmm. But it works on Macs, PCs, and iPads, and both their software, like Designer and Photograph, use the same file. It's .af files. On all three platforms and for both software.
Cool.
I'm like, what? So, just like one file. Yeah, just use it everywhere. It's all. I'm super impressed by this thing.
So I'm hoping to try it out for my scan pipeline. And if so, if it works, I will recommend it to, you know, there is a vintage computing connection in that. That's what I'm scanning. So. Mm-hmm.
And I recently made stickers for Kevin to print.
Yes.
To give away or postcards to give away. And I had, I think, knocked those out in Illustrator. So in that sense, that's kind of a retro podcast, and I would have done them in this. So mm-hmm. That's my retro take on it.
Cool.
A bit of a stretch.
Retro or not, I'm glad to have heard about it.
Mm, yeah. Cause I'm constantly looking for alternatives, and frankly, most of them are like Linux software. Like I'm like, well, this would be fine, but this is not a professional tool, or I would not trust this with my company's actual marketing or something, or mm-hmm. how would I send this to a pre-press shop? And Adobe kind of has locked up the world, but these things, you know, more and more stuff is more open, like PDF formats and TIFF files and things. And this might actually go into my workflow. I'm hoping, like, so it's been a bright spot of my day. And Cosmo Music, on the other hand, you know what you did.
All right. Earl. Take us back to retro times.
Well, sure. I think I mentioned on the last show that I was getting an upgrade board for the PET, but at the time, did I actually have it? Do you remember? It's all
no, I don't think so. I think you were about to put it in.
Yeah, so it came in the mail, and I put it in, and I love it. The installation was straightforward. You just pop out the 6502, put it in this board, and then put the whole darn thing into the PET. This small board. And with some dip switches, you can select which PET version ROM and BASIC that you want, and whether you want to use the memory, I think, or not. Of course, I did. You know, I mentioned last show, I know I mentioned this, that when you bought a PET, if it came with 8K, it stayed with 8K, because the Commodore drilled holes in the motherboard. Thank you, Commodore. But with this card in between the CPU and the main board, it, you know, just completely eliminates that restriction. So now I got RAM galore, and so I decided, hey, it's time to do some programming on this thing. One of our listeners had actually recommended a good tool chain for assembly language programming, a program called 64 TASS, T-A-S-S. And one of the neat things about it is it has a syntax file for the Vim editor, so if you like that editor, which I do, you can get color coordinated syntax for your 6502 assembly language, and then put it through the assembler, put it over to the PET, and then I realized that the key mapping in the PET emulator in Vice was just really screwy, and I couldn't use it with my laptop. So I sat around making a new keymap file, which I've now finished, and it makes using that emulator on my laptop just beautiful. You know, the PETs have the weird keyboards, and so there's all kinds of approaches to how people try to emulate that on a modern keyboard, and most of the approaches I don't like very much, but what I like about the Vice emulator is it lets me make my own key mapping file, which I did. So there
you go. The key mapper? I'm the gatekeeper.
Yes, exactly. And I'm on a cleaning kick, so yeah, somebody stop me, because I'm just, you know, taking 99.9 isopropyl to, like, everything around me. The cats are running away from me like this. Stop it. But there's a lot of controversy about how you clean the insides of old computers. Some people say, take the boards and put them in the dishwasher. And then when you're done, stick them in the oven at 200 degrees or something for a while to bake out all the water. I'm like, really? Are you serious? But a lot of people do it that way. I'm kind of scared of that because these old boards had a bunch of lead on them, right? I mean, in the 70s right. and 80s, they didn't make these things out of safe stuff like they do today. And so I'm not putting that stuff in my dishwasher and my oven. I'm sorry. Other people said, yeah, use the high percentage isopropyl alcohol. It's perfect. Evaporates really quick. Not going to hurt anything. Other people said, nah, don't do that. That's not a good idea. I'm like, I don't know what to do. So I thought the isopropyl seems like the safest approach. So I tried it on a board that was broken already. Worked great. Went to, you know, my next least rare kind of board. I started working through this. I bought a bunch of anti-static cleaning brushes off of Amazon that are made specifically for cleaning static sensitive electronics and that kind of thing. So now at this point, I've cleaned the inside of the Apple IIe Platinum. I cleaned the PET. I cleaned my IBM PS2 Model 30. I've cleaned a bunch of the PDP-11 disk cartridges. And, you know, I can't seem to stop. So, you know, somebody slow me down.
That's actually a really interesting topic, though, because often I you know, clean the outside of things, and there's always lots of discussions about that, about retrobriting, about keeping the outside aesthetically pleasing, but much less so about cleaning the inside of stuff. Like, I normally don't get rid of the big clumps of dust bunnies if they exist, snip out any batteries and replace those, and that's it.
Well, and the thing is, a lot of the retro computers, I don't actually worry about that much cleaning the inside. In a couple of these cases, they were just really grimy. Like, this Model 30 kind of looked like it had been out in the rain. And so I really wanted to clean the inside just so it wasn't so incredibly disgusting. I wasn't going for factory fresh. I was just going for, you know, doesn't look like it just got unearthed from a landfill sort of thing. So that's my deal. What about you, Paul?
Yeah, well, I've been I guess I can sort of sympathize a bit with the cleaning, although my cleaning has been more like moving large objects from one place to another. But
macro cleaning.
It turned out that I basically had, there was one of the web servers that lives in my office that, you know, does modern things, ran into a power problem, and so it was powered down, and so I took the opportunity to move it away from where it was in the corner and move a bunch of other stuff where it, you know, in the place that it freed up. So, cause I had been waiting, cause I, you know, this is sort of a mission critical server and I didn't want to shut it down, but since it was already down, I moved it anyway, before powering it back up. But so I've had a chance. I had a 5150, that had been kind of sitting on top of file cabinets that I have now taken down, and a couple of Apple IIs that were piled on top of it, and they're you know, so I've been kind of dusting off the top, and it's kind of neat. I'm now hoping I can put at least my 5150 somewhere that I can actually use it, you know, actually plug it in and see it go. Although I noticed I have one of the monitors, I think, no, what is it, 5150, the monochrome one, rattles a little bit when I move it. So I think I may have to open it to see what it is that's rattling around in there.
But you don't want to know.
My pet monitor does that. And I mean, I looked and looked and looked. I could not figure out what is rattling around in that top monitor compartment. So just figure if it blows up one day, then I'll know.
My fear is just that it's like a screw or something that's going to like touch something. So I want to make sure that it's not at least metal. Hopefully it's not like the bones of a mouse. So I scanned, you know, those Time Life books that we mm-hmm. talked about. I did cave in and buy them.
So awesome.
So they did arrive. They're big. And I have all 24 of them. I'm not actually sure. It's going to take a little bit of work to figure out what order they are supposed to go in. But I picked one, and scanned it. They're super shiny. So they're kind of hard to scan, and they I don't know. It worked out all right, but it was kind of a lot of work to do the one. I still have 23 to go, but I did. I tweeted the link to the scan of the one of them, and it's pretty cool. I mean, the one I did was speed and power, and it sort of talks about Cray's and cooling supercomputers and how parallel processing works in order to speed things up, and you know, yeah, it's. I was pretty surprised actually at the sophistication that was in there. I mean, I sort of suspected it from the pictures that were in the auction, but I think they will be of some interest to read. So, and actually, the other thing too is I think it's a revised edition. So I think it was actually published in like 1990 or 1991. It's even though it was originally 1987. So I'm quite surprised actually how late that was as well. And let's see, the only other thing that I was going to mention, I think, I can't remember if I mentioned this or not before, it may have just slipped by me, but there is a documentary made by Jan Tenhaven that will be coming out, I think, soon, or available sometime soon, called Silicon Valley Revolution, and we'll have a link to the trailer in the show notes to it. It was at some film festival, month or two ago, and so we can watch the trailer, and I don't know what the distribution is going to be like on that, but it is basically just talking about it's interviewing various people who are sort of important in the you know, Silicon Valley Revolution, and includes what's their name, the VisiCalc people, Dan. Among the things that they did was they interviewed the creators of VisiCalc, and the thing
what
that
what are their
that,
names?
See, you're just being mean now. Dan Bricklin and Bob Frankston, yes. But the cool thing about that was that the computer that they're using on screen even in the trailer, but also in the movie was one I provided. So
it's
my computer that's in the movie. So my Apple II will soon be famous.
That's pretty awesome.
But and I don't know when this will actually come out. The movie itself looks like it'll be pretty cool. But I don't. And I think I'll be told because of my participation, but providing the equipment when it is actually distributed somewhere. But I have not yet been told any such thing. So, and I guess that's it. Any other thoughts anyone wanted to share? Perfect. So that came in. Oh, that wasn't short. No, it was not short at all. Nope.
Failed miserably, but that's what
we
do.
But that is it for this show. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group, which is at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to us at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. Tell us about whatever vintage gathering that we have forgotten that is coming up. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. Please write a review on iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And until next time,
Retro compute.
Retro compute.
That timing was amazing, Garrett.
Well, perfect.
Why am I the only person that has that dream?